softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling, calling for you and for me. See on the portals, he's waiting and watching, watching for you and for me. Come home, come home, ye who are weary, come home. Earnestly, tenderly, Jesus is calling, calling, oh sinner, come home.
This is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Willie Nelson cover Softly and Tenderly. A few weeks ago, we did Rolling Stones' top 20 cover songs, and we promise you that we do our favorites today, and then one day we'll take your favorites. We're also going to ask songwriters. We're going to start to interview some of our best songwriters in America. We're going to ask them for their favorite covers as well. And Softly and Tenderly is a Christian hymn composed and written by Will L. Thompson in 1880. Allegedly, when evangelist Dwight L. Moody was in the hospital, barred from seeing visitors. Although Thompson had arrived, Moody insisted that Thompson be let in, whereupon Moody told him this: "Will, I would rather have written Softly and Tenderly, Jesus is Calling, than anything I am unable to do in my whole life." And I think Willie Nelson would agree. And that was one of Greg's favorite covers. And then the other, well, the original, Somewhere Over the Rainbow by Judy Garland.
Some place where there isn't any trouble. Do you suppose there is such a place, Toto? There must be. It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon, beyond the rain.
And that song was written by Harold Arlen, who, by the way, we've got to do an hour on his life. We could do an hour, actually, on how this song got written. There was a great article in New Yorker magazine about how this song came to be and how E.Y. Harburg, the lyricist, fixed it, because there was a problem in this song. And when you hear the story, you won't believe it. It's terrific. Judy Garland sang it in the movie, and it launched her into megastardom, one of the great first singing actresses. And now we've got the cover that Greg likes the most. And Greg, how am I pronouncing this singer's name? What's his name?
Don't ask me, ask Jesse.
Jesse?
I've got it written down here. Hold on. It's Israel Kamaka Vivo Ole.
Is. Known as Is. And here is his version. A demo session from 1988 that turned into a smash. Two covers. And now we move to Jesse.
I think it should be noted, though, that this song was done in one single take,
yep,
which is amazing.
And then it disappeared for a while on a producer's table.
Yeah.
And then 4 or 5 years later, the session was played to someone else, and voila,
They played it in the movie Life is a House, Life is House, something like that.
Yep. And
when it took off. Yeah.
Well, now to Jesse's pick. And the original song, well, it's known for its incredible saxophone riff. And it's Jerry Rafferty's 1978 smash hit, Baker Street. This song, which folks had come to know and love for that sax riff, well, that saxophone riff had actually been sort of lifted from a song called Half a Heart. And take a listen. This is Steve Marcus.
Close.
It is darn close. Back then, there wasn't intellectual property lawsuits, but today, oh my goodness, that is a slam dunk. That's not the cover, though. Jerry Rafferty is not covering or stealing Steve Marcus's work. When we come back, you're starting to hear right now the beginnings of this cover, and it is Jesse's favorite. It's the Foo Fighters version, the guitar replacing the saxophone on Baker Street. More covers after these messages. This is Our American Stories.
Nights out in a bar room. Liquor was the only love I'd known. But you rescued me from reaching for the bottom and brought me back from being too far gone. You're as smooth as Tennessee whiskey. You're as sweet as strawberry wine. You're as warm.
Listening to David Allan Coe's recording, the original recording of a great song by Dean Dillon and Linda Hargrove. And Dean Dillon was one of George Strait's key writers and one of the great Nashville writers. And that's the original version. This is Jesse's number two. And we are doing our top cover songs. We did Rolling Stones a few weeks ago. Everybody loved it. And they said, what are yours? And by the way, we'll be asking you what yours are in our next version. And Jesse's favorite cover version of David Allan Coe's. And by the way, George Jones did a hell of a cover. But here is Chris Stapleton's more bluesy, countrified bluesy version of the song.
Used to spend my nights out in ballroom. Liquor was the only love I'd known. I
rescued me from reaching for the bottom and brought me back, being too far gone. You're as smooth as Tennessee whiskey.
And there you have it. And Chris Stapleton's touring, opening for Guns N' Roses right now in some parts of the country. And that's a heck of a show. Now we're on to Alex's picks. Alex isn't here.
Oh.
This is painful, but we decided to play it and expose Alex's musical tastes. And they are what they are, folks. We're not judging. Britney Spears is toxic. Here it is.
Baby, can't you see I'm calling?
Okay, I can't do anymore. That's very tough. But this is the cover song. Again, it's not the original he likes. It's the cover. And this is Local H, their version of Toxic.
Baby, can't you see I'm calling? A girl like you should wear a warning. It's dangerous, I'm falling. Escape. I can't wait. I need a hit. Baby, give me it. You're dangerous. I'm loving it.
Is one of his favorites. We got to give him a second chance to redeem himself.
We got to incorporate a gong here. It's just not fair.
I think that's rough. That is rough.
The rest are a lot easier on the ears.
They are. Let's take, by the way, this takes guts to cover this song. This is the original, and it's Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and John Bonham and company doing what they do best. This is Kashmir from Physical Graffiti. It's hard to stop playing that. That actually is, I think, a radio crime to stop playing Kashmir. But here's the cover. Maya Bysshe's version, an Israeli-born American classical cellist. Here she is doing her version of the Zeppelin classic. Thank you. And now we go to Brother Joey. And Brother Joey, well, we're going to start off with the original. And you already know what it is. And how many songs, by the way, can you say that about after three hits of a snare? Billie Jean, Michael Jackson. And now for the cover, and it's the Civil Wars, and they were a band that was together for a brief time. By the way, John Paul White is the male vocalist here, and he's a heck of a talent. Let's take a listen to the Civil Wars cover.
She was more like a beauty queen from a movie scene. Said, don't mind me, but do you mean I am the one who will dance on the floor in the round? She said, I'm the one who will dance on the floor and around. She told me her name was Billie Jean, and she calls the same. And every hair turned with eyes dreamed of being the one who will dance on the floor and around.
And there you have it, the Civil Wars version, their cover version of Michael Jackson's song. That is quite something, actually. We'll go out with that and continue with our American Stories cover songs, our rebuttal to Rolling Stones cover songs, the 20 best that we played only a few weeks ago.
Be careful what you do. The lie becomes the truth. Really, not my love. She just a girl who claims that I am no one. But the cat is not my son. She says I am one. But the cat is not my son. For 40 days, never 40 nights, Lois on her side. But who can stand when she's in demand? Her schemes and plans. Cause we danced on the floor and around. So take my strong advice. Just remember to always think twice.
If I drove a truck
and I were a waitress
and I ordered coffee
and I poured you some,
then you'd stop by on your way sometimes later.
And if we arm wrestled, I'd see that you won.
I eat my baby, ride easy, ride high in the saddle all day.
If your loving is good
and your cooking ain't greasy, the chuck wagon, and we'll ride away.
If I were to win some pain.
And you're listening to Johnny and June Carter Cash, Baby Ride Easy. Originally written and recorded by Richard Dobson. This is John Wood's chance now for his covers. And we are doing our favorite covers. We did the Rolling Stones Top 20 a few weeks ago. Go to ouramericannetwork.org and take a listen. It was terrific. But we had certain songs and artists that we thought should have been there. I'm sure you do, too. We'll be looking for listeners' requests soon. This is John's favorite cover of that song. And let's take a listen.
I
I drove a truck. You were a waitress. I ordered coffee. You poured me some. Then I'd stop by on my way somewhere later. If we mud wrestled, I'd see that you won. My babe, ride easy, ride high in the saddle all day. Loving is good, often easy. I fall off the wagon and you ride.
And that's Father John Misty, his version of the Johnny and June Carter Cash cover, Baby Ride Easy. Next up, the original, John Lennon's Imagine. And now, the Woods cover, his favorite, Imagine, covered by A Perfect Circle.
Imagine there's no heaven, and it's easy if you try. Hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no country. Kill or die for. No religion to. Imagine all the people.
And there you have it. Now, before we get to my favorite cover songs, I just wanted to play one or two from my favorite cover singer. And there are very few cover singers out there left, let alone that are famous and can pack houses. And if you ever get to see Joan Osborne as she tours around the country, do it. And let's take a listen to the original that she covered and made. And she just kills clubs with this. Aretha Franklin had a shot at this record and turned it down. Dusty Springfield did it. It was a big hit once, and then came Pulp Fiction. Take a listen.
When they gathered around and started talking, Cousin Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was.
And that came off the album Dusty in Memphis, and that Stax sound is right there. Let's take a listen to a live version of Joan Osborne. And when we come back after these messages, my favorite covers. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Cover songs.
Well,
for the hour.
Was the son of a preacher man, he was, yes he was.
From me on the slide, taking time to make time, telling me he's old man, and learning from each other's knowing, looking to see how much we're growing. The only boy who would ever move me was the son of a preacher man. All the boy who would ever groove me was the son of a preacher man. He was, yes he was.
And then there was a documentary about the band that recorded almost all the music for all of the great Motown records. And the singer they chose, this band, to close out this show in Detroit was none other than Joan Osborne. There's a terrific documentary on it. Let's take a listen to the original version of What Becomes of the Brokenhearted. And this by Jimmy Ruffin. And when we come back, you're going to hear Joan Osborne's cover of this song and then my few favorites of all time cover songs here on Our American Stories, our favorites, the crew's favorites. More after these messages. We're listening to Joan Osborne closing out the spectacular documentary, and it's the legendary band, the Funk Brothers, that played almost all the great Motown classics for all of those great singers. Let's take a listen to the way Joan closed things out with these old-timers.
What becomes of the broken hearted?
And that's Joan Osborne, one of the great cover singers in this country. And I've had the privilege of seeing her so many times. And now we get to my three favorite covers and my favorite songwriter in the world, Bruce Springsteen. Well, this one he wrote for Patti Smith. But here's his version.
Take me now, baby, here's I am. Pull me close, trying to understand. Desire's hunger is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed. Come on now, try and understand.
But it was Patti Smith who in 1978 made this a smash hit, and it launched her career to the world. Here it is.
Take me now, baby, here's I am. Pull me close, try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed.
And by the way, Bruce also wrote Pink Cadillac for a pretty good singer and Fire for some pretty good singers. He loved writing R&B for women and African-American women, no less. And now, one of the classics from Broadway, a song called Summertime from the classic opera, George Gershwin, Porgy and Bess. Let's take a listen to the original. Voices were what theater voices sounded like back then. Very affected. Wouldn't exactly pass for musical theater today. But Gershwin's lyrics, Stephen Sondheim, perhaps the greatest lyricist in the history of Broadway, said, those are the best lyrics ever written in the musical theater. Listen to Sam Cooke handle these same words. A very different and more stirring version.
Summertime. The living is easy. Fish are jumping and cotton is high. Your dad is rich and your ma is good looking. Don't you cry.
Very different version. Very different version. Now, I think we're going to add one more to this mix because Jesse just called it out. I want to play Otis Redding's original version of a song he wrote that a lot of people don't know was his song because somebody else made it much more famous. Let's take a listen to Otis Redding, one of the great soul singers of the late 1960s. And here's what happened when Aretha Franklin got her hands on it. And that made the Franklin fortune, but it also made Otis Redding's family a whole lot of money, too, because he was the writer of record. And last but not least, my favorite cover song, because it's my bride's. And let's go with the original, a band I'm not too crazy about, nor is she, but one that's popular. And it's Chris Martin, it's Coldplay, and it's The Scientist. Close out our favorite cover songs, the crew's favorite cover songs on Our American Stories, with Willie Nelson's recent and stirring rendition of this Chris Martin song.
Take me back to the start.
And we close things out. Our favorite cover songs, next time it's yours. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and it's time for our regular series called Final Thoughts, where we hear final thoughts from people who are dying, and also final thoughts from folks about their loved ones, eulogies, tributes, etc. Anything that stirs the soul about someone lost. This week's Final Thoughts feature is from Tim Carney. Tim is the senior political columnist for the Washington Examiner and a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His story is about his late nephew, J.P. Kilner, whose namesake, Pope John Paul II, was born on this day in history in 1920. Here is Tim's moving tribute.
Nothing can prepare you for seeing your one-year-old nephew in a casket. Nothing can take away his parents' agony, and nobody could have expected how much good work this helpless baby would do in just 14 months. John Paul Kilner was born with an advanced case of spinal muscular atrophy. He was nearly paralyzed at birth, and his body just deteriorated further as he grew. My sister-in-law Elena and her husband Pat brought JP home as soon as possible and began the 24-hour-a-day job of keeping him alive. Someone was always at JP's side, monitoring blood oxygen levels, suctioning mucus through his tracheostomy tube. If Elena's younger sister, Suzanne, who then became a nurse, or a hired nurse named Denise weren't on duty, either Pat or Elena just did without sleep. Daily saving the life of an immobile kid with a fatal disease raises some fundamental questions. What is the point of such a life? That raises a prior question. What is the purpose of any life? Pat and Elena are devout Catholics from strong families, but their answer to this question can't be set aside as some teaching in the catechism. It's the truth written on the human heart. Jesus said,
"Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment, and the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments.
This is our purpose. This view is not uniquely Christian. It's understood in other religions and in secular worldviews. In this regard, John Paul lived a superior life. He exuded love. Before he lost control of his facial muscles, he beamed smiles that, on multiple occasions, made grown men literally sob. Babies can love those around them with the pure, unconditional love that we all should show. Also, JP drew love out of others. Neighbors, relatives, strangers cooked meals, gave time and equipment and money to help the Kilners. JP's brothers and sisters showered him with affection, and Pat and Elena sacrificed immensely to care for him. Before the wake at St. Patrick's in Rockville, during an observance called Stations of the Cross, we read a gospel passage in which Christ explains our duty to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, and to visit the sick.
"Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me."
Clearly a call to charity, this is also an exaltation of parenthood. Even more so, this exalts the work of caring for helpless JP. Tribulations both reveal character and form it. JP's struggles revealed his parents' heroic virtue and fostered virtue in others. Pat and Elena saw John Paul as a blessing, and they generously shared that blessing with the world. They took him wherever they could, in a chair rigged with a ventilator and an IV. Elena shared even wider by penning hopeful, contemplative letters to John Paul every few weeks, which she posted on a blog. One friend of mine, who never met the Kilners, read the Letters to John Paul blog. She wrote me, "John Paul's story made me want to be a better person." John Paul continued shaping souls even in dying. A priests at St. Patrick's took confessions during and after the wake. He commented afterwards that he heard some of the more honest, searching, and contrite confessions he's ever heard. More than 500 people attended the funeral. One non-Catholic mourner was moved so much by the Mass, she told Pat, "Now I understand why you're Catholic." So John Paul, who never spoke a word in his life, was the greatest evangelist of love, faith, virtue, and hope I have ever met. I don't think Pat and Elena foresaw all this as they sacrificed and toiled for JP. They just did what was right, understanding the, quote, incomparable worth of the human person, in the words of JP's namesake, Pope John Paul II. Father Drew Royals, Pat's high school friend, gave the homily. He said to Pat and Elena, "You saw so clearly that John Paul's life possessed a dignity that was radically equal to that of everybody else. His medical condition was simply the battlefield upon which this young warrior prince would carry out his campaign." At the funeral mass, we mourned a calamity. The pain of JP's death pierces the heart again and again. Also, we thanked God that we were blessed with John Paul for 442 days. Father Drew reminded us, "This blessing carries with it a great responsibility. If our love for this little one has enlarged our hearts, then that means that now we must love all the more. Your work is not done."
And he will raise you up on eagle's wings.
And this is Lee Habib. That was Tim Carney. And John Paul's story made me want to be a better person. My favorite line from that piece. And of course, it's true, as John Paul II said, it proved the incomparable worth of the human person. This is Lee Habib. Final thoughts, our American stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're being joined by Victoria Gardner Coates. The book, David Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art. And Victoria, I want to start at the beginning of this book, and with a cover, actually. And my goodness, what an imposing figure on that cover. You make a guy feel like he needs to get in shape. I want to start with David and the story that inspired the title of your book, David Sling, and how it relates to democracy. Tell us how this cover came to be. Why David's story?
Well, the David is really the kingpin image, or object rather, for this book, because while it is one of the best known objects on the planet, almost anyone will know, oh, that's David. Very few people know that it was commissioned by the Republic of Florence, not by the Medici family. If people know much about it, they tend to think a bit of it as a Medici object, the family that became the Dukes and then the Dukes of Tuscany and then the Grand Dukes of Tuscany in the later 16th century. And they very cleverly sort of appropriated this great work of art. But in its original context, the Medici had actually been exiled from Florence. The Republic had been restored, and Michelangelo was a very passionate supporter of the Republic, and he comes back to Florence to carve this great statue as a figure of warning to the people of Florence that they had to remain ever vigilant to defend their precious Republic from the many, many threats that were encroaching around it. Because one of the great things about Florence was its extraordinary prosperity, because the first hard currency, the florin, was minted there in the early 13th century, this became one of the great economic powerhouses of Europe. And so there was a lot there worth taking. And so you had a series of imperial encroachments from, say, Milan, and then the Medici were trying to come back. So the David was there as a figure of warning.
A few years ago, Victoria, as you may know, Malcolm Gladwell came out with a book titled David versus Goliath. And he suggested mm-hmm. that David wasn't the underdog everyone thinks he was because of his ingenuity, because of his faith. Is the same true about democracy?
Well, I think it is. If you go back to the book of Samuel, which tells the story of David, you have Goliath taunting the Israelites for, I believe, 30 days, and no one coming forth, everyone being too afraid to challenge him, until David shows up, and he doesn't hesitate. He's a child, he's a young shepherd, he doesn't have any armor, but he has absolutely no fear because he feels completely confident, both in his faith in God, but then also in his ability with the slingshot, because he would use that to defend his sheep from wolves that would try to attack them. So he had complete confidence. And if you think about it, that combination of ingenuity and divine protection would give you a lot of confidence. And each of the free systems in this book all believed they had very personal protection by the divine. In Athens's case, the goddess Athena, in the later examples from the Christian god, but that protection was very real and provided them with their strength.
You know, and it's interesting in that Gladwell book, it was almost as if you're reading it and thinking, wow, if the Vegas handicappers only knew afterwards what they didn't know before, Goliath would have been the underdog. I mean, his size versus the speed of David plus God's protection, Goliath never had a chance, Victoria.
Well, right, and that's where I think we can continue to have great confidence in if you use David's sling as a metaphor for democracy, that even though many of the states in David's sling should not have been successful, you know, if Athens is a rock, you know, Rome is a marsh. The only really great thing about Florence is it's flat. It's easy to get to, so it could be a market town. You know, this don't seem like particularly wonderful attributes. But through the sling of democracy, they're able to punch so far above their weight and really take out the apparently strong, big states.
That's right. I want to read a beautiful section of your book, David's Sling. Quote, throughout history, various kinds of metaphorical slings have enabled individuals and societies to rise like David above seemingly insurmountable difficulties and reach impressive heights of achievement. One of the more consequential of these was devised on a rocky outcropping on the Greek Peloponnesus some 500 years after the 500 years after the famous confrontation between David and Goliath, albeit by a group of men who had little interest in either of them. What the Athenians invented on their citadel was a new political system of free, self-governing people. They called it Democratia. Talk about what role art played then and what art says about them, Victoria.
Well, what happens in Athens, Lee, is really extraordinary because you have this city-state, and that's what Greece was really made up of at this point, a group of small city-states, which is based around that gigantic rocky outcropping that is the Acropolis. And art had always been important to the Athenians. They had a very strong school of sculpture and of architecture. But right around the year 500, they have a series of very dramatic political upheavals. Basically, what happens, it's an economic breakdown in that the keep getting further and further in debt, and basically this becomes a vehicle for their enslavement to an ever smaller upper class. And so the people up at the top are doing just fine. The people of the bottom, an ever-increasing pool, are doing terribly. And eventually there's a revolt against this. And the upper classes think they're going to be able to crush it, but then some of their own number join with the people and say, this is an untenable situation. We cannot go on this way. And instead, they propose that a certain number of the population, you have to be male, you have to participate in the military, but if you fill those two requirements, you get to vote on how the city is going to be governed. And so for the first time, you have, this is direct democracy, that rather than electing leaders, you as a voter vote directly on pieces of legislation. And then the individuals can gain a little bit of additional power through persuasion. That's how Pericles comes to power. But it is this truly remarkable moment. And the Athenians know it. They know they've done something unusual. And when Pericles comes to power after the wars with the Persians, the great triumph of the Athenian people, he believes that they beat the Persian Empire. And your listeners may know, for example, the famous story of the Spartans at Thermopylae is a major episode in this war. After this extraordinary victory, Pericles proposes that the most beautiful monuments should be erected in Athens to celebrate the extraordinary Athenian democratic city-state that had led the Greeks against the Persians. And that's when he decides he's going to build, first and foremost, the Parthenon, the most beautiful, most elaborate white marble temple that the Greeks had ever seen, to make manifest the celebration of this victory.
You know, while we're on the subject, just going back to David Sling, and before we dig into another break here, Victoria, I wanted to just talk about Israel, because the David Sling is still very literally being honored in the nation state of Israel. What meaning do you take out of this, that this is still alive, this very real term?
Well, it was one of the more amusing coincidences of my professional life, because I had thought of the title David Sling. I was very proud of it, but I hadn't really told anybody yet. And I was in a professional meeting with a pro-Israel group, and they started talking about funding for David Sling. And I couldn't figure out what on earth was going on. How did they know? And it turns out that they were actually talking about a missile defense program, which most of your listeners probably know about, the wonderful Iron Dome that intercepts the small rockets that come out of, for example, Gaza. David Sling is a larger, a longer range deterrent that takes out some of the more powerful weapons that might be used by, say, Hezbollah, for example, against Israel. And it actually should be implemented this year. And it's great. It's a joint program between the United States and Israel. So it's something we're doing for our mutual defenses. And it really struck me, that coincidence, that I would be using that name for a book about art and democracy, and the Israelis would choose it for this ingenious system of defense, which is what is really preserving their remarkable democracy and allowing it to flourish even against the most severe threats on the planet.
And against all odds. This is Lee Habib. The book David Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art by Victoria Gardner Coates. More after this. And by the way, you can catch all of this material on OurAmericanNetwork.org. This is Lee Habib. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now we turn to Carl Zinsmeister's weekly segment that we call Sweet Charity. And it's brought to us by the folks at Philanthropy Roundtable. And you can read so much of their great material at the Almanac of American Philanthropy. And we love to talk about the generosity of this great country. And nobody does it better than the Philanthropy Roundtable. And so here is Carl Zinsmeister with his latest installment of our weekly segment, Sweet Charity.
Many of you will remember the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. The ALS Association is the charity set up to fight Lou Gehrig's disease, and their fundraising gimmick to raise money for the cause went wildly viral a couple years ago. People would challenge their friends on Facebook or other social media to donate to the cause within 24 hours, or else you had to dump a bucket of ice water over your head. Most people ended up doing both. Here is the soundtrack from the video that President George W. Bush posted to YouTube after he was challenged.
I've been challenged by several Americans to bring awareness to the ALS campaign. To you all who've challenged me, I do not think it's presidential for me to be splashed with ice water, so I'm simply going to write you a check.
At this point, just as President Bush is scratching his signature across a check, a very familiar woman, looking elegant in pink, tiptoes into the shot, brandishing a white pail above her head.
That check is for me. I don't want to ruin my hairstyle.
Now it's my privilege to challenge my friend Bill Clinton to the ALS challenge. Yesterday was Bill's birthday, and my gift to Bill is a bucket of cold water. For those of you interested in more information, please look up ALSA.org.
Every participant put his or her own twist on the donation challenge. Here is the YouTube recording of Charlie Sheen's contribution.
Hey, everybody. Charlie Sheen here with the Ice Bucket Challenge. All right, here we go. Oh, wait. That's not ice. That's $10,000 in cash, which I am donating to the ALS Foundation because, let's face it, ice is going to melt, but this money is going to actually help people. So, I am hereby calling out John Cryer, Chuck Lorre, and Ashton Kutcher to identically do what I just did. Come on, guys. It's for a great cause.
Obviously, Americans had some fun with this. And guess what? That annoyed some experts and journalists. More dour do-gooders described this as nothing but a wet t-shirt contest for vain and shallow people. Environmentalists argued it was a waste of drinking water. A Slate writer asserted that, quote, a lot of the participants are probably spending more money on bagged ice than on ALS research. Ezekiel Emanuel, a medical academic and brother of President Obama's first chief of staff, predictably argued that taming disease is much too important and serious a task to be taken on by charity, amateurs, and everyday citizens. This was a job for the government. Emanuel insisted in a television interview that philanthropy, quote, is very unlikely to be transformative. We need to put this in a much larger context. The National Institutes of Health funds a lot of basic research in this country, over $30 billion per year. So this is really very unlikely to be transformative. A similar attack was made by Congressman John Dingell, who expressed skepticism about the value of direct citizen action. What these critics didn't acknowledge is that government medical research funders, for all their value, are very bureaucratic. They're not particularly inventive. They feel that they have to spread their resources across many special interests, and they can't do everything. Indeed, I looked up how much money the federal NIH put into research on ALS in 2014 when the Ice Bucket Challenge was created. The answer? $40 million. Well, guess how much money this silly private fundraising effort by ordinary Americans raised for ALS that same year? Try $115 million. And a lot more than that, by the way, in follow-up contributions once people had been made aware of the need. The Ice Bucket Challenge has become an annual fundraiser for the ALS Association. Every August, you can expect to hear the ice cubes start clinking again. And there's an even more wonderful twist to this story. You know, when you're taking on a medical problem, it isn't just the amount of money that matters. It's also how flexibly and intelligently you let scientists make use of the funds. One of the serious problems with federal funding is that it comes with so much red tape that the scientists who win grants are often limited in what they can accomplish with the money. And because the government boards that dole out the funds are so timid and risk-averse, more unconventional scientists, who sometimes make the biggest breakthroughs, often never get funded at all. In the Almanac of American Philanthropy, I quote directors of many of our nation's top science labs explaining why donated funds are so hugely valuable to them. They cite the willingness of donors to try new things, even if it sometimes means failing, the lack of attached strings, the patience and longer time horizon of philanthropy. Those are the reasons that when lab heads describe to me the private gifts they get for science research, they use words like these: enormously valuable, able to take risks, flexible, not decided by committee, money that lets you push the frontiers, gold, and magic. Which brings us back to our story about Lou Gehrig's disease. A significant chunk of that $115 million that the ALS Foundation raised through the Ice Bucket Challenge was quickly shipped off to researchers at Johns Hopkins University. And within a year, those donations were paying huge dividends. The team at Hopkins announced a major breakthrough earlier this year in understanding the cause of ALS. Not only that, but they reported that the expensive clinical trials needed to translate this new finding into possible life-saving therapies were already paid for and on a fast track to patients, thanks to the gush of money donated by Ice Bucketeers. As he made this dramatic announcement, scientist Jonathan Ling offered a personal statement. He said, quote, "I've been reading a lot of stories about people complaining that the Ice Bucket Challenge was a waste and that scientists weren't using the money to do research and so forth. I assure you, this is absolutely false." Dr. Ling then pointed out that the surge of donated money has allowed his lab to conduct high-risk, high-reward experiments that may have opened an entirely new path to beating this disease, which today is slowly suffocating about 30,000 people. So, the next time some smarty pants tells you that charity can't fix the big problems, that only government has that power, that little people should leave tough issues to the experts, you just smile and then dump a bucket of ice water over their heads.
And there you have it, another great installment of Sweet Charity. And that's Carl Zinsmeister. And it's the Philanthropy Roundtable that brings us this great material. And if you want to read all of these stories and so many more, the Almanac of American Philanthropy is where you can find some of the best stories about American generosity and sweet charity. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. To hear all of our material, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. This is Lee Habib with Our American Stories, and we bumped across an inspirational story on the website of Opportunity Lives that we just had to share with you. It was titled, "How One Charter School Student is Transforming Youth Relationships with Police." And that charter school student is with us now, Rashad Redd. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Rashad, this is really an inspiring story from someone young, and we don't have it tell enough great stories about young people in our country who are doing great things. You were born to a remarkable single mom, it sounds like. And before we even get into anything, talk about her before we even have another sentence or move another minute.
Yes, well, she is the greatest mom in my perspective. She's supported me throughout this whole thing. Once I told her about, you know, my idea of some way connecting police and minority youth, she totally supported me. She's been a single parent ever since I can remember, and she's totally supported me throughout my life. All my endeavors, she's been behind me, and it didn't stop at this.
Well, you were born into a tough neighborhood and
right.
found your way to a charter school where you've really done quite well, the Mentorship Academy in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And you were witnessing the all-too-common problem of bad relations between at-risk young men, particularly in communities like yours, and the police. Talk about just what you were seeing on the streets every day. Describe it for us.
I saw so much animosity between my friends, people that I knew, and the police officers. It was such a disconnect between the two. I knew some people who wouldn't even consider calling the police when something went wrong because they felt like that was the problem. And that startled me because what I see in the news, in the media, on the daily, it made me feel like I didn't see enough solutions. I didn't see enough people trying to make this better. And I'm sure there are, but I really didn't see it. And I knew I couldn't let my friends go on having these feelings of just pure anger because of what they've been seeing their friends and their family members go through and seeing people die, go to jail. And it's just perpetuating the same narrative that all officers are bad or all black children, black kids are bad. And I feel like if they could connect somehow, maybe we could fix this problem.
Well, Rashad, you had something that so many people need more of, and that's empathy. But you had it both for the police and for the at-risk youth like yourself. But it's one thing, Rashad, to feel empathy. It's another thing to do something about it. Talk about what that next step was. You had this feeling. You were having these observations. What did you actually go and do?
Well, a professor at LSU sent me an application to do a TED Talk, and the application said, what would you like to change in your community? And me and my teacher, Ms. Leatherman, talked about it. She said, what would you like to see change? What bothers you? Because, you know, TED Talks give you a platform to talk about issues like this. So I said, I want to create something that puts police and youth together in a way that helps expose the humanity in both of them and possibly have that transfer to real life to where when they see each other in these intense situations and they consider each other's perspective. And we decided to call it I Am More, where the police officers and youth get together at schools. And the students come with pre-prepared questions, and they ask the officers things that have always puzzled them, things that have always confused them. They ask about high-profile cases. They talk about their daily lives. They hit all the, you know, news points, big media stories about brutality and things like that. But what really is inspiring during these meetings is when you see the conversation shift from really tension, stirring moments to where they're just talking about regular everyday life. Who's their favorite football team? What jerseys do they wear? Regular things about life. And that's the point, to somehow show them that they're no different.
Yeah, we are in the end all the same, and we know this. And yet somehow we as human beings are always trying to divide ourselves. How does it actually work? How do the students in your school and the police get to know each other? What do you do? How do you bridge that gap? What are you actually doing? Talk about that.
Well, we first meet with the students, and I can tell you that is very nerve-wracking because I know how they feel about police. We meet with them, and we honestly tell them, we want you guys to meet with some police officers. We share your name anonymously. And a lot of students decide to share their names, but there are a few who choose
during the meetings, when we get the police officers together with the students, to not share their names. So when introducing themselves, they don't say their names because of the fear they have towards police. But at the very beginning, we meet with the students and we tell them our mission, which is to connect police officers and youth like them, and that the community needs it, and that this potentially can save lives of not only them, but the police officers. So I ask them to come up with all the questions that they've always wanted to know. And in that stage, surprisingly, they're very eager. They see the news stories. They know everything that's going on. They come up with tons of questions. And then after a lot of talking and preparation about how it will take place, how we will all sit in a circle and not to be intimidated and to speak your mind respectively, we then have a meeting and the kids come in the room, the police officers, and we begin asking those questions. And the officers explain as best they can why things are the way they are. And most importantly, students will ask a question like, why do police officers not respond as quickly in my neighborhood as opposed to different ones? And the officers give honest answers to those type of things. They tell them, you know, sometimes priority levels are different in certain priority levels are different towards a crime, whether it's sometimes it's more severe when weapons are involved. They give them sensible explanations for why the things they are, but they also admit that things could be totally better. And they get to see what these kids go through, especially in rough neighborhoods. And I hope that they leave knowing that these kids aren't all bad. And definitely the students, they see these police officers in a totally different way. They say it usually at the end that I totally thought of you guys as monsters. If I relied solely on the media, I would think of you as monsters. And in some cases, officers do bad things, but not all officers are bad.
Yeah, that's so good to realize that difference. And tell me, how did your friends and your fellow students react when you first told them about this idea of sitting down with people who are not like them? I mean, sitting down with police, of all things. What was their initial response?
They thought I was out of my mind. They thought that I was trying to do something that was a little too brave, a little too courageous, or a little too lofty of a goal, because a lot of them totally didn't like the police. Like, it's so much animosity, and that's why I feel like there's still a lot of more work to do. But my mother, she was totally behind me. She always kept me inside in our neighborhood because of how rough it was and stuff like that. She taught me to have respect for police, but she also taught me to be aware of my surroundings and aware of my rights and aware of, you know, all the situations I might get myself into, and that I do have rights and that I do owe police officers respect. She was the main reason why this happened. So, with friends, it was rough, but with my family, they stood behind me.
Well, that's all you need is the family behind you to give you the courage. You know, I wanted to ask you one quick question. We have about a minute and 45 seconds left. Tell us about your school, the Mentorship Academy, and what it's meant to your life. You used to be in a different school that didn't rise to your needs, but tell us about what this Mentorship Academy has meant to you and your life and the opportunities before you, Rashad.
Man, being in mentorship allowed me to have this initiative happen. I don't know if I went to another school, maybe public or another, if I would be allowed to have police officers come here and do this type of thing. This school is so innovative in its teaching methods and its allowance of a child to be creative. They allowed me to be creative. When I brought this idea to my principal, Mr. Webb, he was totally behind me. He was inspired that I would want to do something like this. And I just thank everybody at Mentorship Academy for allowing me to be free, be creative, and tackle things that are outside of school, outside of the academic scope.
Well, Rashad, we really appreciate you. We love your creativity. You're inspiring us with this story. Inspiring Opportunity Lives to write about it. And folks, you know, what can you say? And this is why we struggle so hard for school choice, and profoundly so. And Rashad, thanks for all you're doing. And we look forward to talking to you more. Keep in touch with us because we want to follow your story. I know there's a lot more coming from you, my friend.
Thank you so much.
You bet. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And you don't get much better than that. A young man in a tough neighborhood trying to let his friends know what cops' lives are like, and trying to let the cops' lives know what their lives are like, walking in another man's or boy's shoes. Really important for us all to do. Have empathy, share, and sometimes just shut up and listen. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.